Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most speaks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two segments up today. First, in a little while, we'll speak with Liz McNichol, who is an expert on state finances for the Center of Budget and Policy Priorities in D.C., about the dismal state of state finances, the fiscal crises affecting about three-quarters of the states in this country, really serious fiscal crises, not just minor budget shortfalls. We'll talk to her about the breadth and depth and significance of all that. And then at the bottom of the hour, Yanis Varoufakis, who is been on this show several times before, talking about the Greek economic crisis. The inspiration for this interview was an article in the current issue of Vanity Fair by Michael Lewis. Informative, entertaining, but kind of snotty, and I suspected rather shallow. We'll talk to Yanis Varoufakis to fact-check the story that Michael Lewis told in Vanity Fair. Before all that, some words in the economic news. A somewhat better tone to the recent economic news in the U.S., though only in the sense that it always feels kind of good when someone stops beating you over the head. These things are after all, relative. To repeat some of the analysis that the KPFA and podcast audiences heard last week, but not the WBAI audience because of a Friday morning release, the U.S. employment report for August came in a bit better than expected. Total employment fell by 54,000, but that was pulled down by the disappearance of 114,000 temporary census workers. That was entirely expected, part of a long decline in the number of temporary census workers to zero. It had peaked at over 500,000 a few months ago. Private employment, which is the engine of this splendid capitalist economy, rose by 67,000. Those private sector gains were narrowly distributed, however. Nearly two-thirds of that gain came from healthcare and social assistance, and another good chunk from leisure and hospitality. Most other sectors showed only small changes. In other words, there are really no dynamic sectors leading us out of the economic wilderness. Healthcare and bars and restaurants won't do it. And I say this as someone who loved bars and restaurants. The unemployment rate ticked up a tenth of a point to 9.6%, close to its high for this recent cycle. Also, the number classed as not in the labor force, because they're not actively looking for work but nonetheless wanting a job, rose. Most of the rise in household employment, which that survey found, came from part-timers. The number of full-timers actually declined. Nearly a third of those unemployed in July dropped out of the labor force in August. So had they stayed in, the unemployment rate would have been even higher. So while overall employment grew, at this rate of increase, it would take almost 10 years to make up the private sector jobs loss since the peak in December 2007, and that's not even allowing for population growth. It's good to see positive numbers, but we really need to do better than this. First-time claims for unemployment insurance, filed by people who just lost their jobs, fell a sharp 27,000 last week, but a lot of states didn't report good data to the Labor Department because of the holiday weekend. So we won't really know what happened until next week. My guess is that some of the spike in the unemployment claims figures in recent weeks was overdone, and we're getting back to a more normal level, normal being rather crummy. On the brighter side, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released its Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, JOLTS, data for July. It showed a decent increase in the number of vacancies, almost 200,000, but a much smaller increase in actual hiring. A couple of weeks ago, I discussed the skills mismatch theory of unemployment, favored by some bourgeois types, which holds that the reasons that we have so many unemployed is that workers are defective and don't have the skills that employers want. The small rise in openings may actually reflect that, but the unemployment rate was half this high just a few years ago, and I don't think the workforce changed all that much in the intervening couple of years. So the real problem is an economic crisis, not a worker quality crisis. There are now 4.8 unemployed persons for every job opening. That's down from 6.2 at the end of last year, an improvement, but a nearly 5-to-1 ratio is still extremely harsh. And despite the rise in the number of openings, the number of separations, is firing, layoffs, and quits, that also rose. And it wasn't because people were quitting in search of greener pastures. There are no greener pastures. No, they were downsized or right-sized, whatever, or whatever it is they're saying these days. So even the good news comes with bad news attached. And finally, a few words about the political scene. We're coming upon the 9th anniversary of 9/11. There's something about that event that brings out the worst in a lot of us. No doubt the conspiracy theorists will be working overtime this weekend with their tales of how Dick Cheney did it. These folks are too much with us. They're an embarrassment and a disgrace, and I wish they'd grow up and realize that the reality of American social life is pretty much an open book. The vast disparities between the rich and poor, the ongoing degradation of the earth, the increasing brutality and idiocy of our public discourse, the lock that money has over government, you name it, it's all right out there, pretty much in the open. It takes some work sometimes to figure it out, but that's what we're here for, at least for now. Silly tales of secret cabals are a lie and a distraction. And another thing, over the years, there have been many on the left who've almost, maybe not even almost, rooted for economic smash-up. Presumably, this would deliver the system into our waiting arms. Well, we've had quite a smash-up, and if anything, the right has been the major gainer. In the economic sphere, the austerity crowd is gaining traction. And in the more cultural sphere, a bunch of bigots are riding high. There are the birthers who think that our president is a secret Muslim born in Kenya. I'm no fan of our president, but really, this is just ignorance and hatred. And then there's the incredible and repulsive wave of anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim hysteria centering on the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, which is, of course, not a mosque. This is a society suffering from an economic crisis, and a political and intellectual one as well, and the most prominent reaction has been an increasing hostility towards the weak and the foreign. It's repulsive and sad. Crisis is not bringing out our better selves. I can't say I'm surprised, but I can only hope that things will get better. There is, of course, no serious ground for such hope, but, well, hope dies last, as they say. Okay, we'll be back in a little bit to talk about state budget crises. Some of the Haydn Piano Sonata in D, Hoboken, 16, number 42, performed by Alfred Brendel. And our state and local governments are experiencing a serious fiscal crisis, and unlike the federal government, they can't print money or borrow it almost without limit in order to balance their books. Since state and local governments deliver a lot of the essential services that make people's day-to-day lives a little better, I think their fiscal crises are much less abstract and much more real to a lot of people. They're experiencing job loss and service cuts and all kinds of things. So to take the measure of this state and local fiscal crisis, we now have Liz McNichol, who is an expert on that particular subject area with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Behind the News, Liz McNichol.
Thank you.
So the state and local fiscal crisis, it's about, what, three-quarters of the states facing very serious gaps right now?
Yeah, for the budget year that we're in now, all but four states had to close significant shortfalls in their budgets.
And is there any kind of precedent for this in previous downturns, or is this really one for the record books?
The revenue declines that we saw as a result of this recession are basically the largest revenue declines on record.
How much of it is the economy and how much of it is policy? What's responsible for this?
The problems that the states are facing now and that have faced for the last couple of years really are the result of the economy. There's nothing that a state could have done to avoid these problems. The downturn meant that people weren't buying things, and so sales tax is a big revenue source for states. Then unemployment now is almost 10% that feeds into the income tax collections. So it really is a revenue problem as a result of the economy.
How much did states cut income taxes during the expansion, especially at the top end? Was there a sense that good times were here and they could get away with that?
During the last expansion and then the expansion before the 2000, states did cut their income taxes. There has been a pattern of cutting income taxes in good times, raising sales taxes in bad times. So that did contribute to the problem, but again, it made it harder to deal with the revenue declines that came as a result of the recession.
Well, let's review some of the big names. I guess California, and being the largest state, has the biggest problem. What were the dimensions of the California problem?
California's budget shortfalls have been as high as 40% of their budget. If you look at what they would have spent in just continuing the programs that they had on the books and compare that to the revenues that were coming in outside of the federal aid that they ended up receiving and outside of any tax increases that they put in place.
And that is all a bad economy? How much does the tax limitation and that sort of thing contribute to the problem?
In California, they were one of the states very hard hit by the foreclosures and the housing bubble bursting. But the laws that they have on the books there made it much harder to deal with those problems. The requirement for that they need 2/3 of the legislature to adopt a budget, which is more stringent than any other state. Some other states have restrictions on raising taxes. Most don't have on the entire budget. Made it really hard to make the hard choices to try to deal with this solution. So they kind of attempted to kind of slide through for years, and that made the problem bigger.
And what have they been doing in response to this revenue crisis?
States in general or?
Or no, California.
California did raise some taxes. They did also make really large spending cuts and are considering additional cuts. California is the only state that has not yet adopted a budget for the current fiscal year, even though it started on July 1st. So there's still cuts on the table that haven't gone into effect. They did some borrowing as one way to try to get through this.
And despite the cuts and the tax increases, they still have a serious problem, don't they?
Yes, they do, and they haven't dealt with this year's problem, and they're projecting another $20 billion in gaps for the following year, fiscal year 12. And some of the impact, they had to raise tuition at the public universities by 30%, and cut the number of students that they'll be able to serve at those universities, cut education funding, so made cuts in various parts of the state budget.
And California was one of the what's usually called the four most serious housing bubble states. The others, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. How are the other housing bubble states doing? Are they also deep in the red?
Yes, they're still having big problems. Arizona is projecting really large budget shortfalls. They did raise some taxes, and they did some big cuts, but some of the measures they used were one time in nature, and they're still facing a problem next year. Nevada, the gaming industry was very hard hit when people stopped traveling, doing those kinds of discretionary spending, so they're still facing big gaps. And Florida as well, but there seems to have settled out a little bit more in Florida.
And New York seems not to be doing quite as badly as it could be, it seems to me.
Yes. I mean, they weren't quite as hard hit by the housing bubble. They were, of course, hit by problems on Wall Street and the financial industry that affected income tax collections. New York did do a high-end income tax increase and some other measures earlier on.
But New Jersey has a major problem, right?
New Jersey, yes, closed a $10 billion shortfall last year, but faces a problem as almost as big in the upcoming year.
New Jersey is facing deferred problems that go back to the days of Christie Whitman, right? Cut back on pension contributions when the stock market was rising rapidly, and now the bill has come due. Isn't that part of their problem?
Yeah, part of the problem is the bill has come due. Part of the problem that's going to mean that the one of the reasons that they're facing almost as big a shortfall next year is partly due to the economy not bouncing back as in other states. But one of the solutions that the current governor took and previous governors was to reduce the payments into the pension fund. I think Governor Corzine started to bring them back, make those contributions. The last budget that we're in now didn't defer that contribution, which means that it's building up a bill and building up more debt at a time when the state won't have the revenues to deal with it next year.
And I imagine the industrial Midwest has also been pretty hard hit, Ohio, Michigan.
The unemployment there has depressed the income tax collections. So those are some of the states that are facing bigger problems. Places that had a kind of farm industry did a little better than some of the other states. The two kind of groups of states that did a little bit better that weren't as hard hit were states that export, states with farming industries, and then many of the states that depended on oil revenues and have big natural resources were not as hard hit at the beginning of the downturn, although that's changing now.
Well, actually, employment in those kind of natural resource sectors has held up pretty well in this recession. It's almost as if we're becoming a resource-based economy.
Yeah.
Are there any other states that have fared a little better? Texas, of course, is a resource state, but how's it held up?
Texas was doing okay, again, I think because they had built up some money and because they're a resource state. But they're on a two-year budget cycle, so they're just now starting to look at the next two-year budget, and their problems are as bigger than other states now. So I think their sales tax collections for the current year came in $1.5 billion less than what they were expecting. So Texas is now facing the same problems as other states.
How much of all this is an unemployment problem, and how much of it is that there was a massive cutback in consumer spending? People really tightened their belts very hard during the depths of the recession. Is this a mix of those two things that are really the economic factors responsible for this state fiscal crisis?
It is a mix. Again, when the housing bubble burst, people cut back on spending. So the first thing we saw was sales tax collections going down. But then as that fed into the rest of the economy and unemployment increased, the income tax collections have been a problem. Sales tax collections now are coming back a little, but they were down so low that, you know, you're kind of digging yourself out of a very big hole. That's good news, but not, you know, we're nowhere near pre-recession levels. Income tax will take a little longer to rebound.
I'm speaking with Liz McNichol, who is an expert on state finances with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in D.C. How quickly do state budgets recover when an economy turns up? Are they sort of a simultaneous or a lagging indicator?
Normally, it takes a couple of years after the economy comes out of recession for state budgets to recover, and this is such a deep recession. We're now projecting that the budget gaps for fiscal year 2012, which would start in July of 2011, so a year from now, will be as big as the ones that they're faced this year and last year. And it'll be harder for states to close those because the federal aid will have run out by then. Any of the kind of one-time measures that states use, their rainy day funds have generally been tapped.
What kind of economic recovery are you projecting that those forecasts are based on?
That's assuming that the unemployment rate doesn't, you know, go down significantly until sometime next year.
Which is a pretty safe projection.
I think so, yes. Yeah, from what we're seeing, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, well, are there signs that the state finances are at least stabilizing along with the rest of the economy, or are they still deteriorating?
I think they're stabilizing. The reports we're seeing now are that state revenues are coming in at or maybe a little above what the state's built into their current budgets. The problem is that means that, you know, in many states they're declining 3% when they expected them to decline 4% or something last year. So, again, the revenues are down, I think, like 15% compared to pre-recession levels when normally they would have grown 5% each year over those 2 years. So we may have, maybe, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, but the end of the tunnel is a long way off at this point.
Why do revenues decline so much more than broad economic indicators like GDP would?
Because states depend on the sales tax and their income tax, it feeds into state revenues more than just general economic growth.
Because GDP is down, 5 or 6%? 15% revenue decline seemed very sharp compared to what was a deep recession, but not 15% down.
No, but state revenues generally fall as a share of GDP during a recession, so you get that on top of the recession.
Now, most state tax structures are fairly regressive, right? The sales tax... states without an income tax, there's no progressive tax at all. A lot of real estate taxes are not particularly progressive. How does the structure of state tax systems affect what happens to them in recessions?
It means that it's hard. The states that have very regressive tax structures, and most states have a regressive tax structure, some are more regressive, it means that they aren't able to build up adequate rainy day funds or reserves in the good times, and then when the decline comes, they don't have that cushion so that it will be hard for them to recover when the economy starts growing.
Well, some states that rely heavily on income taxes, like, say, New York and California, they're fairly progressive. And when the upper class is doing well, the revenue really comes in, right?
Yes, it does.
But that's not true of a place like Texas where there's no income tax.
Right. It grows less, not as quickly, so they don't have the money to put aside.
And in the current environment, raising taxes is the equivalent of a Catholic denying the virgin birth. So how are the politics of this playing out at the state level? I mean, is it all about budget cuts, or is there some way to get tax increases passed a legislature that must be very reluctant to pass them?
Well, up till now, 33 states have done at least some revenue increases. So, and it's certainly in other recessions – it's typical for states to raise taxes. They have to balance their budgets, so the choice is cutting. If you exclusively cut spending, those are going to be really bad cuts in education, in healthcare. Things that people see and care about. So that's also not a politically palatable solution. So I think we will see when states have to make these really hard choices next year that everything will be back on the table, revenue increases, tax increases, as well as spending cuts.
And I imagine that a lot of lower levels of governments, the cities and the counties and such, are experiencing similar problems, right?
Right. There's a lag in the time that the housing value decline feeds into property values. So we're really seeing now kind of a double whammy on local governments. Their property values are declining so that that can affect their property tax collections. And one of the places that states have cut back and will cut back next year is aid to local governments, school aid that goes down to the local level because local governments are running the schools. So I think that's the next front where we're going to see really big hits where local governments are going to have to decide whether to cut spending or whether to raise their property taxes.
And a lot of there's a fair amount of federal aid to states and states in the stimulus bill. Is that how much of it was there, and is that now expiring?
Yeah, in the current year budget, there was about $60 billion, which was able to close about a third of the shortfalls that states have been facing. In 2012, that's essentially gone. There'll be a little bit left of the education aid. But other than that, it's gone, which is why the shortfalls that states have to deal with on their own are actually going to be larger than the ones they had to deal with in the current budget year, even though the total gap is a little bit smaller.
And what would I guess a lot of the austerity at the state level and the local level would offset whatever federal stimulus we had. How much do those things balance out?
We estimate that closing a gap of $140 billion, which is what states originally faced in FY11, and that they're facing next year, is about 1% of gross domestic product. So if you did that all with spending cuts and or tax increases, that could take like 900,000 jobs out of the economy, which is why the federal aid was so important. It saved teachers' jobs, saved professors' jobs, was enabled the states to cut their budgets less so that they could keep that money flowing to both to employees and to state employees, but also to contractors with the state, and got it into the state's economy and saved jobs that way.
So as the federal stimulus package expires, and then state and local governments also have to cut, the whole public sector is going to be a drag on economic growth for at least a couple of years to come, isn't it?
Yes, it will. But also, it will depend in part how much of a drag it is will depend in part on how states deal with the gaps they're facing. And if they should do it, close the gaps all through spending cuts, which is unlikely, that would have a much more drag on the economy than if they both cut spending and raise revenues. Because some of those revenue increases, especially if they're a tax increase that's targeted toward high-income people, the money for that will come out of savings. It won't all come directly out of spending that would have happened. And so it's a less of a drag on the economy.
And looking forward, why is there, you said there's a couple of year lag between economic recovery and state and local budget recovery. Why is there such a long lag?
Well, because employment tends to come up, or in recent expansions, it doesn't immediately recover. That has a big impact on personal income and on income tax collections. There's also just kind of a administrative timing issue that, you know, you pay 1 year's income taxes partway into the next year, so you're paying taxes based on what the economy was like a year or so ago. So that creates part of the lag.
So this is, all in all, a pretty gloomy picture, and not just for the present, but for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, the fiscal crisis is far from over, but there are things that states can do that will preserve services and have less of an impact on the future economic growth.
Well, let's hope they do it in a humane and sensible way, but you know, as they say, hope dies last. Okay. Well, thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Liz McNichol, who is an expert on state government finances at the Center and Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. Okay, let's take a break for station ID. This is WBAI, not only at 99.5 in your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, hit that donate button. We could always use your help. My name is Doug Henwood. Program is Behind the News. Okay, a little musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the Greek crisis. That's some of the new single from Killing Joke, European Superstate, from their forthcoming album, Absolute Descent. European Superstate, I'm not sure what to make of that, but I'm going to try to figure that out. And thanks, as usual, to my pal Oliver, who provided me with the information that led me to get that nice track. Okay. In the current issue of Vanity Fair, the journalist Michael Lewis, who is quite a smart fellow and a very good writer, but a bit of a cynic, has a piece about Greece called Beware of Greeks Bearing Bonds. And it portrays a country that is on the take, a corrupt country where everyone is cynical and nobody wants to pay taxes, and the whole system is pretty rotten. And Greece, of course, is in a terrible economic crisis right now, and I thought it was it'd be a good idea to fact-check this piece by giving a call to a frequent guest on Behind the News, Yanis Varoufakis, who is teaches economics at the University of Athens, and he will tell us that there is some truth to what Michael Lewis says, but also some untruth. Okay, Yanis Varoufakis. Hello, Yanis. I read in the new Vanity Fair that your country is a den of thieves and con men. Any truth to this?
Well, it's exactly what you would make of an article written in a distant land, relating a view of your own country as a place swarming with financial accountants and engineers and spivs from Goldman Sachs occupying the breadth and the length of the land, where everybody burns Korans and generally does a pretty good impression of creating hell on earth.
Well, there's some truth to that picture. So you're telling me that there's some truth to Lewis's picture of Greece?
Of course. I mean, there is a myriad of truths. I caught myself clapping while applauding while I was reading certain passages. And Michael Lewis writes very well. However, I'm afraid that every great lie is founded upon such a myriad of littler or smaller truths. So even though I have no doubt that Lewis has done his research and that I agree with a lot of the things that he says, the picture that he paints in its entirety is a pretty ludicrous and false one.
Let's look at some of the particular little truths. There's a serious problem with people not paying taxes in Greece, right?
Absolutely. Greece is a rather undeveloped place where the state pretends to be doing its job in providing services and the citizenry is pretending to be paying its taxes. So we are caught in what we might call a low-level equilibrium in which is sustainable on the one hand but pretty inefficient on the other. But I think that if you really want to get to the bottom of things, the problem with Greece is that, firstly, you have quite a low level of industrial activity, of manufacturing, a great deal of service sector that is trying to fill in the gaps. And fundamentally, and this is again somewhere where I would draw a connection between Greece and the United States of America, even though they're very different entities, the real problem is poverty and low real wages. So when you've got people on very low wages, they will find ways of surviving. And one of those ways of surviving is by not paying taxes.
So to compensate for all those years of deficient revenues, the government played statistical games with debt accounting and borrowed rapidly, right?
Yes and no. There have been, of course, statistical tricks. But let me tell you, because I have first-hand experience of that, because I work in an economics department, which supplies government with a number of ministers and high-ranking officials. So, and I've been following what my colleagues and friends have been doing while in government in the 1990s and during the last 10 years. And let me say that they didn't use any trick that they invented. They copied the tricks that they saw their counterparts in Germany and in Italy and in France utilize in order to remain loyal, in inverted commas, to stick to those ludicrous Maastricht rules which supposedly govern the financial affairs, the fiscal policy of every member of the European Eurogroup, every member of the European Union which happens to be part of the Euro.
Greece nonetheless ended up more deeply in debt than other members of the Euro area.
That's right, but that's only because our productive base is so thin. I don't think that the public sector is considerably larger than it is in Italy or even in Germany. If you look at the size of public sectors across Europe, you'll find that it's around 23 to 25% in terms of total employment. Reading Michael Lewis' Vanity Fair article, one would have thought that public servants are swimming in riches. It's not true. Public sector pay is very low. It's the lowest in Europe, perhaps, you know, only competing with Portugal as far as how low the level of pay is. But the main problem is that we're not producing enough stuff that the rest of Europe and the rest of the world will want to buy. When you are locked into a common currency with giants of productivity and technological innovation like Germany, and you can't devalue your currency in order to take into account the loss of competitiveness of the Greek economy vis-a-vis the German economy, what you end up with is burgeoning deficits.
The orthodox response that would flow from this is that Greece has been living beyond its means, so the country has to tighten its belt if it's already pretty tight. And if it can't resort to a currency devaluation, since it's inside the eurozone and has no influence over the value of the euro, it has to undergo an internal devaluation, which is a polite way of saying steep wage cuts. What do you say to that?
Well, this is precisely what they say. And this is, in fact, what's happening. We have a very serious devaluation in wages. What this point of view neglects is a fundamental truth about capitalist economies that I thought that we learned in 1929, but it seems to me that we never learn anything for long enough. And that is, the truth being, that what goes up does not necessarily come down, ending up in exactly the same spot as you were before you went up. The simple point I'm making is this. If you have an increase in real wages in Greece per unit of labor or output relatively to Germany, because Germany is expanding its technological base and is being more efficient, if you try to arrest that change, to reverse this by pushing real wages in Greece down, all you're going to end up doing, instead of going back to where you started from, the original competitive position, you're going to end up creating a depression in the Greek economy, which is not going to increase its productivity, but in fact, it's going to ensure that there will be even fewer investment projects in Greece, fewer increases in productivity, more technological backwardness, and, in the final analysis, lower demand, not just for Greek products, but also for German products. So if you have a currency union like we have in Europe and like you have in the United States, and one area like Ohio in the United States or Greece in Europe is lagging behind in terms of its productivity and efficiency, and what you do, what you say to that region is, okay, tough, you've not been doing very well, so accept lower wages. All you're going to do is push the whole union down along the path that leads to generalized recession. Of course, the recession will not be the same in the deficit backward places like Greece and Ohio. And apologies to listeners from Ohio, I just picked it up at random. They will suffer a lot more than the more advanced technologically and in terms of productivity and efficiency places. But the whole union is going to be brought down by such a policy of targeting the laggards, the backward places or regions, and imposing upon them austerity.
When we last talked, you quoted a German acquaintance at the European Central Bank who said that Germany just doesn't care what happens to Greece because Germany thrives and exporting high-end consumer and capital goods, and a collapse in the purchasing power of the Greek working class wouldn't matter at all to them. You're saying that this approach will blow back and hurt Germany after all. How do you reconcile these positions? I guess what I'm asking is, just what is Germany thinking?
Well, I think that Germany thinks that it can run its macroeconomy like a shop. A shop that is efficient, that is producing goods that people want to buy, and that if they keep the standards of production up and their costs low, they can sail the stormy seas of a global crisis. But this is where they're wrong, because a macroeconomy does not operate like a shop. And however great the strides that Germany takes in technological terms and in creating goods that other people want to buy, if the demand is not there internationally, Germany is not going to manage to keep its nose above water. In the last 2 months or so, Germany has done very well because there was a boost in exports, especially to China and to Japan. That has, unfortunately, I'm pleased for Germany, but unfortunately what it has done, it has lulled them into believing even more strongly that they can sail the stormy seas of the international recession by exporting. Now, the chickens are coming home to roost, though, because China and Japan are now in the process of winding down both their growth and the degree to which they import stuff from Germany. And Germany is going to have to turn to its backyard, and its backyard is countries like Greece, Italy, France, and so on and so forth. And they cannot continue to outgrow their own deficit and economic crisis problems by selling to us laggards more when we are in a very serious recession. So yes, I think that their commitment to outgrowing this crisis through export growth is in the end not sustainable. Let me put it very simply. After 2008, the credit crunch and the global financial crisis, the United States has ceased to be the magnet that attracts the surpluses, the trade surpluses of countries like Germany, China, and Japan. So what we are facing now globally is a dearth of global demand. And there is no way that Germany can expect to escape that conundrum by increasing its surplus position vis-a-vis China, given that China's own strategy is to get out of the doldrums of the international crisis through exactly the same strategy. So I think that within the next 6 months, you're going to see that Germany is going to come to realize that they have to fix their own position vis-a-vis the rest of the Eurozone or get out of it themselves.
I'm speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. You've been talking mainly of an ideological problem, a misunderstanding at the root of Germany's position. But is there some material way that Germany could benefit from a depression at the periphery of Europe?
It is benefiting. The fact that Greece is a basket case, and so is Portugal and Spain to a lesser extent, but still a basket case. Ireland is even a worse basket case. The fact that the periphery of Europe is going through this debt deflationary spiral is keeping the euro down. This means that German exports to the rest of the world are becoming more inexpensive, and therefore Germany is benefiting from that. But nevertheless, this is not a sustainable situation, because the crisis in the periphery of Europe is not something to take lightly. It's not something that you can keep burning like a fireplace in the distance, keeping you warm. It has the capacity of blowing up in your face. And if it blows up in Germany's face, and I'm very fearful that it will, then Germany is going to be burned by that. Meanwhile, even reductions in the euro are not going long-term to shore up Germany's export surplus position vis-a-vis the rest of the world, if the rest of the world also goes into contraction. And the rest of the world may very well go into a contraction caused to a large extent by the fact that Europe has not come to the party. And by this I mean that over the last 2 years, the United States, under Obama primarily, and China, are, and to a lesser extent Japan, are using all the means at their discretion to shore up the world economy, their own economies, and global demand through huge stimulus programs. Europe has not followed. Europe has been a free rider. And that is because of Germany's insistence that they continue to play shop. They continue to treat their own economy as if it doesn't affect the rest of the world, and it's just a little shop doing its business. This kind of strategy is going to be catastrophic for Germany, Europe, and the world.
You're speaking earlier of a lack of an industrial base and a pervasive low wages. How did Greece get to this situation? Was it a fall from grace, a long-standing structural maldevelopment, or what?
Greece had its first industrial revolution in the 1920s and 30s. In 1936, It was a tumultuous period, but nevertheless, it was a period of economic growth and progress. Between 1936 and 1955, I would say, we had a civil war, which involved Nazis, local fascists, a very bleak period in our history. The result was, if you have thousands and hundreds of thousands of Greeks in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, and so on and so forth at the moment, it's because Greece became desolate as a result of that civil war. In the 60s, it started pulling out, late 50s and 1960s, but then the oil crisis in 1973 put Greek industry back into reverse. And then we had a period in the 1980s when industry was effectively taken over by, I'll dare say, Germany. Most of the large companies were taken over by German companies. They were shut down and turned into warehouses selling German-produced industrial goods. And this was the price we had to pay for entering the European Union. In exchange for our productive capacity, we were allowed in. In the 1990s, there was a lot of credit-driven growth, and this is what Michael Lewis quite expertly explains, a consumption-driven, debt-driven boom, which created very visible signs of wealth, relative wealth, of progress, of consumerism, if you want. And it is indeed the case that this was more or less of a bubble, and that bubble burst. But it's the same story worldwide, is it not? That the period from the oil crisis in the 1970s to 2007, 2008 were characterized by financialization of one kind or the other. And now, post-2008, the whole world is facing a different reality. And Greece is struggling to find its place in that reality. The tragedy is that just like in the 1950s, the devastation that preceded during the Civil War occasioned a mass migration wave of unskilled labor to places like the United States and so on and so forth. Now I'm witnessing, being at the university, not as large a wave of migration, but a very significant one, only because it consists of skilled labor. University educated, some of them highly educated, young people, dropping everything and leaving the country. And this will be the legacy of this current crisis in terms of further shrinking the prospects of growth in Greece if we lose our human capital.
We have only a little time remaining, but is there a way out? Should Greece default, break out of the euro, and bring back the drachma? What could or should Greece do to get out of this hideous death spiral?
It's one thing to have a discussion as to whether Greece should have been in the euro or not, but it's quite another to discuss whether we should get out of it, because, you know, as I said before, some things cannot be undone easily. I think that we cannot get out of the euro now. It is impossible to get out of the euro. It would be a massive disaster, and I don't even think it is even feasible, but that's a big discussion as to why. What I think we should do, our government should do, is renegotiate the terms of the IMF Eurozone package, according to which the Greek state debt is being serviced through loans from the IMF and the Eurozone. And what I think should be renegotiated are two things. Firstly, the interest rates that we pay, it's pure usury. And secondly, the macroeconomic policies which are imposed upon the Greek government, which instead of bolstering the economic basis from which we're going to pay off our debts and allow us at the same time to carry out all the reforms which are necessary in order to fight corruption and so on, are driving Greece instead into a black hole. So the Greek government should renegotiate the terms and conditions of its agreement with the Eurozone and the IMF.
And what about domestically? Lewis talks about a preposterously indulgent retirement regime, with hairdressing defined as a hazardous occupation and therefore eligible for early retirement. Is there any truth to any of this?
A very small amount of truth. What happens here is, look, Michael Lewis didn't stay in Greece long enough. And had I had the chance to talk to him, I would have pointed out a very simple thing. Greece doesn't really have a social security system. So the poor pension system is trying to make amends for the lack of a social security system. So let me put it simply. If a builder, a construction builder, gets injured at the age of 50 or gets slightly disabled or something like that, right? There's no way of giving him, until he retires, some kind of social security benefit. So what happens is he's pushed into the pension system. So the pension system acts as both. If you look, therefore, at the combined expenses of the pension and the social security system that an advanced country ought to have, the Greek pension system is carrying the burden of both. As for the hazardous merit payments, as they're called, this is part of the... I think he's got a point, Michael, is here. We should change that. But what happens is this. Governments have traditionally tried to reduce the expense to the state of giving pay rises to very lowly paid workers by giving them bonus payments. And that is because the bonus payment doesn't count towards your pension. So let me give you a very simple example, my personal experience. Half of my salary is in bonuses. Now, they're fixed bonuses. They're not bonuses for something I do over and above my normal university duties. But half of my salary takes the form of different bonuses. They have silly names like library bonus and productivity bonus, as if, you know, as a professor, my productivity can be measured. But it's fixed. It's not even measured. There's no. The only reason why they do that is because when I come at the age of 67 to be pensioned off, my pension is going to be computed on the basis of my main basic salary and not the bonuses. So I'm going to get a ludicrously small pension. So when Michael Lewis comes and says, oh, look at these people, they're getting all these bonuses, they're not bonuses. They're just disguised parts of my salary and of our salaries, the purpose of which is to reduce state expenditure on us when we grow old.
Finally, Greece is in the early stages of a deep recession. What's the economic scene look like now?
Well, we have minus 5% growth. So, and I just found last year we had 20% reduction in industrial production, 30% reduction in construction, and I just read that in the last 2 months we had a further decline in industrial production by 10%. Unemployment officially has risen from 8 to 14%. My figures say that it has gone up to 20% and rising. So this is as deep a recession as one can have, at a time when the government is committing itself increasingly to greater austerity and to borrowing more money from the IMF and the Eurozone at huge interest rates compared to the ones that Germany or the United States pay in order to service existing debt. And the problem with this is that it's one thing to say, okay, well, we have to tighten our belts to repay off our debts. It's quite another to borrow more and more money at very high interest rates when we know that we won't be able to repay those debts. It's like getting a new credit card by which to pay off the previous one. And we know that only tears and blood awaits anyone who does something like that.
I've been speaking with Yannis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. The article we referred to throughout the interview was one by Michael Lewis, a smart fellow and a fine writer, but also a bit of a wise guy, in the current issue of Vanity Fair. You can find it on the web at vanityfair.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this bit of wonderful fluff by the Wombats from a few years ago. Let's dance to Joy Division and celebrate the irony indeed. Till next week, bye.
So if you're ever feeling down, grab your purse and take a taxi to the darker side of town. That's where we're through the dance floor up to the DJ booth. You know what to ask for, you know what to ask for. You ask for Joy Division and celebrate the irony. Everything is going wrong, but we're so happy. Let's dance to Joy Division and raise our glass to the ceiling, cause this could all go so wrong, but we're so happy. Yeah, we're so happy. Let the love tear us apart. I found the cure for a broken. Let tear us apart. Let the love tear us apart. I found the cure for a broken heart. Let tear us apart.